Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today. Lucy Marston, the field manager and farmer up at Hawthorne Valley Farm, will be joining us in a little while on the show to talk about the work that she does up in the Hudson Valley. And before that happens, I, of course, want to share with you a recipe this week and talk to you about some things going on in the news and some great events coming up in our local area. So why don't we start with some of the great events coming up. This time of year, fall harvest, there's so many wonderful events that you might want to take place in. This weekend, October 24th, there's a farm-to-fork benefit dinner at the garden at St. Francis, which is out in North Belmore. And that's an evening of music and a buffet dinner using all local meats and vegetables, local beer and wine. It's reasonable. You can find out more information on my website. Actually, let me just tell you, all of these events are listed on my website at iegreen.com, so you can click on and find out more information about them. October 25th, this Sunday, is a wonderful benefit for an organization raising awareness about the Paris talks that are going to be taking place. And this is a wine and hors d'oeuvre conversation to Paris and beyond. And they're going to be doing a brief reading of a play called Extreme Weather. There's also going to be an auction, an auctioneer. Tickets are $100 for two tickets, $50 for one. And that's going to be taking place in Brooklyn. Again, there's more information on that on my website. Sip-Tea Lounge, a cute little local tea shop in Huntington, is having a couple different events. One is the Pecha Kucha, which is a presentation of 20 slides in 20 seconds each, total of 6 minutes and 40 seconds total. That's going to take place October 29th. It's a free event at 6 p.m. They are also having a mysterious Halloween tea pairing on October 30th at 6:30, and you can go to their website to find out more information and buy tickets for that. Also, October 30th, there's a screening of the film Bag It, organized by the United for Action, and that's taking place in the city at Rutgers Presbyterian Church. On October 31st, there's a harvest dinner out at Shin Estate Vineyards out in Matatuck, great biodynamic wine vineyard, and David, one of the owners, is an incredible chef as well, so check that out if you want to spend a beautiful day out on the east end of Long Island. November 1st, the fall market dinner at the Bell and Anchor. That's being sponsored by Slow Food East End. November 1st through 8th is Long Island Restaurant Week. You can take advantage of many restaurants that you might want to try on the island during that week. November 4th on faith and climate change. This is a great program presented by the Sustainability Studies Program at Stony Brook University. It's a free event from 1 to 2:15. November 5th, Edible Escape is being sponsored by Edible Brooklyn. That is a great event. November 8th is the Naval Expo on Long Island. November 10th, United for Action is having another presentation called Zero Waste, and it's a panel of speakers that will discuss about how we can get New York City into a zero waste time frame, you know, within, I don't know when they're saying, by 2020, maybe 2025. Anyway, it's a panel discussion. It should be very interesting. It's taking place at the West Park Presbyterian Church at 7 p.m., $5 suggested donation. November 12th, Capital Food Fight. That's taking place down in D.C., but it's 75 of D.C.'s best restaurants doing a local chef competition on stage, and, you know, it's a battle of the best, and it should be fun. You can go to Capital Food Fight website to find out more information about that. This is a great event, the NESAWG, which is the Northeast Sustainable Agricultural Working Group. It takes a region conference, and that's taking place up in Saratoga Springs from November 12th through the 14th. It's a wonderful opportunity to get together with other food manufacturers, farmers, politicians, people really in charge of looking at our local food system and looking into making a real food shed for the Northeast area. So that's going to be taking place November 12th through the 14th up in Saratoga Springs. You can go to the NESWAG website. That's NESAWG website. Find out more about that. North Shore Land Alliance is having another one of their Walk in the Woods. These are great opportunities. They're always free. And you go out with a naturalist and walk beautiful places on Long Island, and they'll, you know, highlight different things for you, both the wildlife and the habitats that they live in. This one's taking place at the Wawapek Preserve in Cold Spring Harbor. So I encourage you all to go onto my website to find out about more of these great events that are coming up. And things that are in the news. Oh, so many things. This week on my blog, I actually posted a great graphic that showed the 10 large corporations that own almost all of our food. It's really scary because when you go to the supermarket and you see all the choice that we have here in America, you think, wow, look at all these different companies. But the reality is they're almost all owned by a really big company, 10 to be specific. We have Nestle, Pepsi, Coca-Cola, Unilever, Kellogg, Mars. You know, they own just about everything. And what's the biggest problem is that as these big corporations buy up some of the natural food companies, they infiltrate the natural food companies and really try to weaken the organic standards. And that's a real issue that, as an organic chef, I've really been trying to help people become aware of so that they can stay diligent about letting their voices be heard, because the Organic Standards Board is the USDA leg of policymaking that controls the organic standards that everything is judged by and organic labeling. And if they want to weaken those standards, for instance, I know there was a big lobby for organic tomatoes, for instance. You know, you get organic tomato sauce. Well, if in the winter they can't get the organic tomatoes and they want to use regular tomatoes, do they have to, you know, change the labeling? Well, yes, I would say they have to change the labeling or say it's out of stock until, you know, unavailable or whatever. But no, they want to be able to put in regular tomatoes instead of the organic tomatoes and still call it organic tomato sauce because it's an exception to the rule. We don't want that to happen. We want these organic standards to really mean something. And so we all need to stay diligent. And, you know, I also have a spot on my website called Take Action where you can sign petitions. And I know a lot of times people think, you know, signing petitions, what does that do? But it really does make a difference. I mean, if you want to take it to the next step and write a letter or make a phone call, even better. But it is really important for our policymakers to see the numbers in the millions of people caring about our food. Our food is, you know, something that we all share, and it's something that is being infiltrated, and big profit is really at the crux of it, not people's health and not people's right to food. And we all have a right to access to good food. And we can't let these big corporations stand in the way. And we need our government to really know that the people are waking up and that we really care. So this week on my website, you know, there's a petition to ask the FDA not to vote in Robert Califf as the new FDA chief. You know, he is someone that is really not someone on our side. He's been collaborating with pharmaceutical companies for years, and he's really behind a lot of, he's really in bed with the big pharmaceutical companies. So to have him in charge of the Food and Drug Administration just would be a really bad thing. We need someone that is more conscious of the need to put people's health above the profit. And, you know, it freaks me out when I've been spending a lot of time in the hospital lately. I have a family member who's been very sick. And it freaks me out at all the advertisement for pharmaceuticals. It freaks me out at the cost of pharmaceuticals. It freaks me out that there's a new pharmacy opening on every corner. I mean, I just have no compassion for pharmaceutical companies spending so much money on their research that the poor guys are not making any money. I just don't buy that. They are ripping us off. Insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, you know, they're all in bed with this guy, Robert Califf. And so we really want to ask the Food and Drug Administration to vote in somebody else. Also, there's a chain of restaurants, the Darden restaurants. You know, they own Olive Garden, Longhorn Steakhouse, Bahama Breeze, even Seasons 52, which you think of as a healthy restaurant alternative. Anyway, they employ over 150,000 people, serve over 320 million meals a year, and the quality of their food is just terrible. And so there's a petition to really just ask them to, you know, to think more about the foods that they're serving and the quality of the foods behind it. However, I also, you know, just had to do my little pitch here to encourage everybody to cook. That's our safeguard. We need to buy real food, and we need to get back into the kitchen, and we all need to start cooking again, because that's how we are going to really affect our health. That way, if you go out every once in a while and you end up at one of these restaurants that you know the quality of the food is not so good, one meal a few times a year is not going to kill you. It's when people eat at these restaurants all the time that it's such a problem. So I really encourage all of you to, you know, take up cooking. You know, bring people over, invite people over. It's really where it's at, as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, something I did write about this week on my blog was about cancer diets. As I mentioned, you know, I have a family member that's been really ill lately, and they've been diagnosed with cancer. And Western medicine really doesn't offer much. I mean, there's a couple trials that you can participate in, you know, but it's a mixed bag. It's like not quite sick enough to qualify for the trials. And, you know, so do you pray that you get sicker so that you can get into the trial? Because otherwise there's nothing for her. It's really, you know, it's really a very sad picture that is being painted for us. So, as a natural food chef, of course, you know, my belief system of food is medicine is really strong. So I started really looking at the different diets out there for healing yourself from cancer. And of course, like anyone else who has done this, I was overwhelmed. I've been, you know, in this realm for so many years, and I've heard about so many diets over the years. But when you really, you know, when it hits home and it's personal and you're really looking, it is just so confusing. You know, you can go to Mexico for the Gersten diet. You can go to Texas for the Burstein diet. You can, you know, do raw foods. You can do macrobiotics. You can do juice fasts. You cleanses. I mean, there's just so many different ways to go. You know, marijuana for, you know, heal cancer with marijuana. I mean, there's just so many different paths. And so trying to make sense of them is a big challenge. And as someone who believes so much in the body-mind-spirit connection, I also know that these diets will work best if whoever is going on them, if their belief system is 100% into it. So you can't really put pressure on anyone to do any of these things if their heart is not there. And so as a family member and as a facilitator, you know, I can put all these things out on the table and present them to the people I love. But it's really up to the patient, the person that is ill, to find out and to research and do what feels right to them. They have to listen to their gut and do what they believe in, so that no matter what happens, in the end, you know, it was a choice that they made. And so it's a really interesting process. I presented a couple of different things this week on my blog, and as I research more, I will be sharing that with all of you that get my newsletter, and see where it goes. So stay tuned for that. And now before I introduce Lucy to all of you, I wanted to share a recipe that I did this week. Harvesting all my vegetables before the frost. You know, I brought in a lot of eggplant. And one of my favorite dishes that I make is a moussaka, a vegan moussaka. So I'm going to share that with you. But this time I added some more vegetables because I also harvested the end of my broccoli. I had lots of Swiss chard. And so I wanted to put some other things into the moussaka and make it a little more, you know, give it some more vegetables. So I did that. So this is a vegan moussaka fall inspiration, and it's a little bit, there's many different parts to this recipe, and you can will be able to find it both on the PRN website and on my website. So first I'm going to break it down. There's the eggplant and potatoes, and for that you're going to use 2 large eggplants or 4 small ones. Mine were all small at this point that I was picking off, so I used 4 small ones, 3 large potatoes or 6 small ones, half a cup of olive oil and some kosher salt. And you're going to cut the slices, the eggplants, into slices about a half inch thick. The potatoes about a quarter inch thick. And you're going to brush them with olive oil, lay them out on a cookie sheet that you've lined with parchment paper. You brush it with oil on both sides, sprinkle some salt and pepper on it, and you're going to bake them in the oven until they are soft. And you're going to bake them for about 20, 25 minutes. You can also put a sheet of parchment paper on top, especially of the eggplant, so that it doesn't burn. You really want them to just get soft. Then you're going to make a tempeh filling. And for that, you're going to use 2 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil, 2 medium yellow onions, 2 carrots, 3 cloves of garlic minced, 1 8-ounce package of tempeh. I used a gluten-free tempeh. You can use soy tempeh, you know, any type of tempeh. If you need a gluten-free one, you can find gluten-free ones. 3 portobello mushrooms, finely chopped. 2 assorted peppers, and I harvested lots of peppers, so I just used a bunch. And I actually used a couple jalapeno, too, so I had a little bit of spice in there. 2 teaspoons of dried oregano, 3/4 teaspoon ground allspice, 1/4 teaspoon of ground cloves, 1 teaspoon of cinnamon, 1 teaspoon of sea salt, and more to taste if you like salt. 1/2 teaspoon of freshly ground black pepper, also more to taste. 1 can of fire roasted diced tomatoes, 10 sun-dried tomatoes that I pureed, 1/2 a cup of broccoli, I don't mean a half cup, a half of broccoli that I cut into florets, 1 tablespoon tomato paste, and 1 bay leaf. And to make that filling, you're going to start by covering the bottom of a large skillet with olive oil. Bring it to medium-high heat. Add the onions and the carrots and cook those until lightly browned, about 5 minutes. Add the peppers and the garlic and continue cooking, stirring frequently for about 3 more minutes. Then, because I don't want to use 2 pans, I make a space in the center of the pan by pushing all of the vegetables to the side. And then I pour a little more olive oil just in the center and put in the crumpled tempeh into that. And I cook that until it starts browning, and then I mix it up with all the other vegetables. Then I add the spices, the oregano, the allspice, the cloves, and the cinnamon. And you cook that for about 5 more minutes. Then add the portobello mushrooms, the fire-roasted tomatoes, and the salt. Cook that for a little more. Then add the tomato paste, the sun-dried tomatoes, the broccoli, the bay leaf, and let that come to a simmer. Cover it and let that cook just until it's thickened, about 15 minutes, stirring occasionally so it doesn't stick to the bottom of the pan. While that's cooking, you're going to make a cashew sauce. So I soaked 3 cups of cashews in, cover them with water and let that soak for about 2 hours. And that just, anytime I'm pureeing cashews, I do that, and it just helps them to make a really smooth sauce. So I'm going to soak it in, you know, just cover it so it's soaking in water for 2 hours. Then I drain it. Then I mix it with 3 cups of water, 1 1/2 teaspoons of sea salt, a half a teaspoon of ground nutmeg, and 2 tablespoons of nutritional yeast. And I just puree that in a Cuisinart or a Vitamix until that's really smooth. And that's going to be, you know, my mock bechamel sauce. And then I make, for the topping, I'm just going to season some breadcrumbs. I use gluten-free breadcrumbs, but you can use regular ones too, in a cast iron pan with some salt, some minced garlic, some olive oil, and also rind from 1 lemon. And you're just going to toast the breadcrumbs, and you're going to use that both on the bottom of the pan and on the top of the pan. So once you have all those parts done, you're going to assemble this into a large pie. I used a large Pyrex glass pan that was about 10 by 16 inches. You can also use a metal lasagna pan, whatever you have. Sprinkle a little breadcrumbs on the bottom to, you know, first spray the bottom actually with some olive oil. Sprinkle some breadcrumbs on the bottom just to keep the eggplant from sticking to the bottom. And then you're going to line the bottom with the eggplants. And you overlap the eggplants so you can cover the whole bottom with the eggplants. Put half of the tempeh filling in there. Then line on top of the tempeh filling the potatoes. Then put the line it with tempeh filling again, and then you're going to cover the whole casserole with the cashew cream sauce, and then sprinkle the rest of the breadcrumbs on top. And then you're going to bake that in the oven for about 45, 50 minutes until it is golden brown on top, and take it out, and that is it. It's just delicious. It's something that can be assembled ahead of time and baked at the last minute. If you're going to freeze it, you can even freeze it. I actually froze it one time without the cashew sauce, and I added the cashew sauce fresh. So, you know, I froze it before I added the cashew sauce, and that worked really well as well. So, as always, I'd love feedback. Let me know how you like the recipe, and I look forward to hearing from you. So now it's my pleasure to introduce Lucy Marston. As I said before, she is the field vegetable and CSA manager up at the Hawthorne Valley Farm, which is a 4-acre certified biodynamic farm in the Hudson Valley. She's in charge of growing all the vegetables for a 300-member CSA, which stands for Community Supported Agriculture. They also have an on-site farm store that she grows for, 5 weekly farmers markets in New York City, and she's responsible for it all. And Lucy came to the Hawthorne Valley Farm first as an apprentice about 3 years ago and has been, actually, I guess she's been running it on her own for the last 3 seasons. So I'm going to let her tell us more about her work. Lucy, are you with me?
I am. Hello.
Hello. Welcome. Thank you for joining
me
this morning.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Great. So can you tell us first a little bit more about the Hawthorne Valley Farm? About biodynamics as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So Hawthorne Valley Farm, we are a 400-acre biodynamic farm, and we're located about 2 hours north of New York City. And the farm itself is part of a bigger nonprofit organization that does a whole bunch of other stuff. But the farm itself, we do, like you said, we have a 300-member CSA, we do farmers markets, we produce about 15 acres total of vegetables, but then on top of that, we also have livestock. We have a 60-cow dairy herd, and with their milk, we make all sorts of farmstead cheeses. We have an organic bakery. We also make all sorts of lacto-fermented sauerkraut. And let's see, gosh, what else do we do?
your cows are only for dairy.
But really,
right?
In terms of the livestock, the cows are our focus because they also supply all of our fertility. We make all of our own compost that we then apply to the fields, and that's the source of our fertility. And then other than the farm, Hawthorne Valley has a lot of other stuff going on. We have a K-12 Waldorf school located on the property, and lots of other educational programs. So we have kids here a lot through summer camps and school year programs, and also do a lot of other community outreach and social initiatives, all focused around agriculture and the arts.
Uh-huh. Do you have any goats? or chickens as well?
We don't have any goats. We had a few years back, the kindergarten had a couple goats that they took care of, but they no longer have goats. We have three sheep, and though our three sheep are mainly used for the educational program, doing fiber arts, and also just getting kids out here, you know, getting them experience working with animals, you know, because a lot of that's not normal for a lot of kids, especially coming in from inner city Hudson, you know, getting out on the farm and working with animals is a really great experience for them.
Uh-huh. Right, for any kids. And then, do you have any chickens?
What's that?
Do you have any chickens?
Yes, we do. We do. I used to myself have a flock of about 30 hens. We don't do them necessarily for production, for mm-hmm. egg production, but we have about 20 chickens that, again, is more so for the educational programs. But in terms of production, our focus is with the cows and with the pigs.
Uh-huh.
So, but then there are some other farm animals around, mainly to support the educational programming that we do.
Uh-huh. And can you explain what's the difference? I mean, I know lots of people have heard about biodynamics.
Yeah.
But they don't really understand what that is. What's the difference between biodynamics and organic, for instance? And, just explain to us a little bit about biodynamics. I know you do weird things of, you know, putting cow horns down into the soil and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So biodynamic agriculture, it's, you know, I like to think of it as kind of a threefold approach to agriculture. It's a holistic, ecological, and ethical approach to farming. And biodynamic agriculture was developed by a man named Rudolf Steiner back in the 1920s, and he was quite prolific working with lots of, you know, different disciplines, agriculture, education, like social theory, economic theory, all this kind of stuff. But
he's also the founder of the
biodynamic
school.
Stems from his work back in the 1920s. And really what a biodynamic farm is striving to do is to create a diversified, balanced farm ecosystem that is really generating the health and the fertility for the farm from within the farm. So really trying to limit as many off-farm inputs as possible. You know, so I'm a huge supporter of organic agriculture and don't want to be critical in any way, but, you know, a lot of organic farms, they are importing fertility. You know, they're buying in their compost from, you know, big chicken operations that are out in the Midwest. You know, they get chicken manure shipped in, or they're shipping in a bunch of soil amendments that are mined from all over the world. You know, so really bringing in a lot of off-farm inputs. Whereas within a biodynamic farm, we're really trying to create that fertility and that soil health within the farm. And so livestock is a big piece of that. You know, the cows supply all of the manure that we then compost, and like I said, that is the fertility for our fields. You know, we will amend the soil when necessary, but we try and limit as much stuff to buy in as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And another big piece within that fertility is, as you mentioned, the biodynamic preparations. And so, you know, to people that are new to biodynamics, it can kind of sound a little out there, sound a little wacky. But, you know, within the time that I've been working with biodynamics, I really feel that there's something to it. And so there are a number of different preparations that we apply. And so first there are the compost preparations. So there are six different herbal preps that we put in our compost pile, and those are different herbs. So yarrow, chamomile, stinging nettle, oak bark, dandelion, and valerian. And those are all put into the compost piles each season. And those are, you know, those are really just kind of healing remedies for the earth that work through the compost and then make their way, obviously, into our soil. And they kind of help, they're catalysts for different microbiological soil processes to heighten those beneficial processes.
Yeah, and you're putting in very little amounts. I kind of think of it as like homeopathy
for
the
soil. It's like homeopathic remedy. You know, it's very dilute amounts. You know, a small, like, for instance, take yarrow, for example. Like, a teaspoon of that, of the yarrow, can treat a compost. Like, we make huge amounts of compost. So imagine, like, a 100-foot-long compost pile, like, that weighs multiple tons. You know, maybe you'll put, like, a tablespoon of yarrow mix in that whole pile. So it's very, very dilute, kind of homeopathic scale applications of these substances. So those are the herbal preparations that go into the compost piles. But then two of our, you know, most important preps are the horn manure and the horn silica. And so horn manure is, like you said, we put fresh manure into cow horns and bury it over the wintertime. And then you dig those up in the spring, and then you apply the substance that you take out of the cow horns, you spray that out on your vegetable ground. And that is really it's kind of a soil treatment. It helps stimulate soil life and those microbiological processes that really help produce really strong plant growth.
Can you explain that a little bit more? You're saying you put the manure into the horn, you bury that in the ground during the winter, and then to spray it, do you make a tea of it?
So to spray it, there's actually this stir. So with the cow horns, you stuff them with fresh manure, you bury them over the winter time, and during those winter months, the manure that you put in those cow horns completely transforms. It's pretty incredible. And then when you dig them up in the spring, it's really this beautiful kind of humus, really healthy, crumbly compost-like substance that you take out of the cow horn. And then you take that horn manure, and it actually goes through a stirring process. And so you put a very small amount, you know, maybe a quarter cup in, you know, we're stirring these in, you know, 30-gallon batches. And it goes through a process of stirring for an entire hour to really, it's kind of potentizing the horn manure, and really allowing different energies and forces to enter that substance, which you then, we use a backpack sprayer to go out and we spray that on all of the ground where we're then about to plant, put in seedlings or direct seed our vegetable crops.
Uh-huh. So if you're stirring 30 gallons, is that being done manually or are you using some sort of machine for that?
Yeah, so we have two different setups. Our 30-gallon one, our 30-gallon stirring setup, you're just doing it by hand. So you're out there for an hour, and it's this really beautiful meditative process where, you know, you're just doing that by hand. I feel like it's a really nice time to really set your intention for the farm and just kind of meditate on really the work that we're trying to do here and what are your intentions in your work. It's all hand stirring. And then we also apply these preparations to all of our hay fields and pastures and the fields where we grow grain. So we're applying these preps, you know, over 400 acres of ground. So we also have a 100-gallon tank set up. And that's mm-hmm. also done by hand, but we have kind of a big paddle that we use to help stir at that volume. It's mm-hmm. all by hand.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. And so how many horns do you need to bury for your 400 acres?
Typically, we bury around 50 or 60 horns each season. Mm-hmm. It's quite a lot of them. But it is obviously, you know, we're on a larger scale. It's definitely possible to, you know, there are much smaller biodynamic farms that are only like 2 acres, you know, so kind of the volume of the preps that you need can, you know, will change depending on your scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and then there's also the second prep is the horn silica, which is basically ground up quartz, and that is put into a cow horn. And you bury that during the summer months. So you bury that in March, typically dig it up in September. And that will go through that same stirring process. But the horn silica is actually you spray that to promote ripening. So the horn manure is used to promote your soil life and the rooting process for freshly planted seedlings and new growth. And then the silica, the horn silica, you spray on your plants to really help. It helps with the light metabolism of the plants. So you spray it when you kind of are wanting your plants to start going towards ripening and when you're about to harvest them. So that's the use of the horn silica.
Uh-huh. And the process is similar to what you described for the horn manure, correct?
Exactly. It's an hour-long stir in those in a big crock of water, and then you go out and spray it on your fields. The horn manure you mm-hmm. spray in the afternoon, and then the horn silica you want to spray earlier in the morning before the sun becomes too intense.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is closely linked with that light process. And so if you spray the silica in the middle of the day, it can sometimes scorch your plant.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So I want to take a couple-minute break, and then, you know, you just touched on the sun. I also want to touch on the moon, because I know the biodynamic farming is very much connected to the cycles of the moon. And so... Everyone who's listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Lucy Marston from the Hawthorne Valley Farm, and we will be right back.
You're listening to PRN. Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Sandy Leon Best, host of Political Analysis. Welcome to the 21st century, where the corporate propaganda machine works 24/7 to manufacture your reality. Every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, Political Analysis challenges the corporate narrative with independent news, analysis, and passionate conversations on the most critical issues of our time. Don't let the corporate echo machine become your truth. Tune in live to Political Analysis or visit the archives at prn.fm. If you like the show, rate us in iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Carrie Harrison with you, inviting you to join me on The Smart Show every Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time. If you're not able to catch me live, you can go to the archives at prn.fm or harrison.fm. Don't forget, it's impeccable behavior to rate the show on iTunes. We come to you each Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time, live from Hollywood, where we bring on the movers and shakers, whistleblowers and muckrakers. There's nothing like it anywhere else, and it's here on PRN.FM. If you like a smart show, then join me, Carrie Harrison. It's Harrison on the Progressive Radio Network. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Join the movement at PRN.FM, your best source for progressive programming.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm here with my guest, Lucy Marston, from the Hawthorne Valley Farm, and we're talking about biodynamic agriculture. Lucy, are you with me?
I am.
Great. So right before the break, you had touched on the sun, and I wanted to touch on the moon. I know, you know, the moon cycles are very much integrated in biodynamic farming, and I wanted to ask you if you could share with us how you incorporate that.
Yeah, absolutely. So a factor that we definitely are working with in biodynamic agriculture is what's going on the cosmos. So what's going on with the planets, what's going on with the stars, and how might that affect the work that we're doing out in the fields? And so we definitely pay close attention to the moon, especially, so full moon, new moon, and we try as much as we can to follow a planting calendar, so thinking that there are specific times based on what's going on astrologically that are ideal for to work with different crops. For instance, there are certain days that are ideal for planting roots, for planting lettuces and leaf crops, for planting your fruiting crops. But the moon is especially important. You know, we really try to link up with the full moon when we do any new planting. For instance, today, the next full moon will be Tuesday, October 27th. And so today we're trying to get all of our garlic in the ground before that full moon. And the reason that is that the full moon, or the moon in general, has a lot of connection to water process. You know, if you think about, like, the moon's effect on the tides. And, you know, that water process is also really important in seed germination and in establishing new plants. And so you really, we have found that trying to plant or seed right before the full moon, you have much better germination. Your plants establish themselves much more strongly, as opposed to if you plant closer to the new moon, where those water the strength of those water forces are not quite as strong.
Mm-hmm. Right. That makes sense.
Yeah. So we're definitely trying. You know, we are a production farm, you know, so sometimes it doesn't work out exactly how we want it to. You know, for instance, if our planting calendar says, oh, today is a great day to plant beets, but all of a sudden it starts downpouring and we can't get into the field, you know, it may just not happen that way. So there is a certain amount of, like, having to be realistic. But we try as best we can to follow that planting calendar that kind of takes into account what's going on, you know, not just, you know, in the world around us, but kind of in the world above us. And that's, mm-hmm. I think that's another thing that kind of sets biodynamics and just organic agriculture apart, is that there's kind of this, you know, even more holistic view of things.
Yeah, I always joke around saying, you know, biodynamics is kind of like organic on steroids. You know, it's
exactly.
Like organic to the next level, you know?
Yeah, organic plus.
Right. So do you also then pay attention to the moon cycles when you're harvesting?
Yeah, as much as we can. You know, that one's a little trickier, you know, because we're kind of, we try and pay attention to it later in the season, like this time of year when we're harvesting our root crops that we want to store for a few months over the winter to be sending to markets and things like that. You know, trying to harvest our root crops on, like, our storage beets and carrots and parsnips on root days. Because it's been found that, you know, they'll keep better, that they'll keep longer, stay fresher. You know, but then, you know, that's another, you know, the realities of being a production farm, that's another, sometimes
right.
The
what makes a root
timing
day?
Of things comes into play. But,
What is a root day?
Yeah, what's that?
What makes a root day? You know, what classifies a day as a root day?
There are a few different planting calendars. The one that I typically use is called Stella Natura. And what makes something a root or a leaf or a fruit day all has to do with what's going on with in the zodiac. So what, depending on where the sun or the moon is in certain constellations, that will affect whether it's a root day. For instance, if the sun, you know, all the signs of the zodiac are either an earth element, a water element, a fire element. And so depending on what sign the sun is in the zodiac, that will say it's a root, leaf, fruit day. For instance, like if the sun is in Capricorn, which is an earth sign, that makes it an earth day, which would then correspond with your root crop.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I mean...
Yeah.
There are things within biodynamics that can make it sound pretty out there, but I think something that's really important with biodynamics is that I feel like right now there are two main impulses within agriculture. There's kind of peasant agriculture, which still the majority of the world practices, like the third world, you know, kind of these more peasant, subsistence farming methods. And then there's like behemoth industrial agriculture, you know, that is kind of terrifying. And I think biodynamics is really trying to find a way in between the two of those, you know, employing a lot of the modern methods, like using tractors, using equipment, trying to be efficient so that we can feed a lot of people, but then also, you know, not really throwing out the baby with the bathwater in terms of all of the wisdom that's out there within peasant agriculture of kind of looking at nature and, you know, looking at really being in tune with the seasons and the elements and kind of the, and also what's going on cosmically. It's like, you know, our ancestors were always looking at, like, what's happening with the stars? Like, what's to help them time the way that they're working with the earth? So I think biodynamics is really trying to find a way to join those two impulses within agriculture to forge a new narrative for how we can go forward and have a really healthy food culture in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like you said, when you think back to our ancestors, I mean, even going back to, you know, ancient Mayan civilizations, I mean, they were always looking at the stars and the things that they built. You know, we look at now, like, how do they build these things without machinery? And it was like they used the energy from the earth and the stars.
Exactly.
And they were connected.
You know, and I think as soon as you say the word cosmic or you say the word forces, people kind of take a step back and they're like, oh, wow, that's all really woo-woo, hippy-dippy stuff. But I think that there's a really long legacy within food production that goes back to that. And I think it's really important to not shove it all to the side and say that it's mumbo jumbo. I think there really is something to that. And so I think biodynamics, at least the way that we practice it at Hawthorne Valley, is really working kind of bringing it into modernize that, you know, and find a way to continue to work with those ideas and those principles in kind of a new more modern way.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you get involved in farming? Were you always interested in farming? How did you learn what you know?
Yeah, so I was not always into farming. I'm still, you know, sometimes still blown away that this is what I've found my calling to be. I studied art in college, but then was doing a lot of environmental education. And then was working on a farm, working with kids, teaching them about farming, but got to a point where I felt like for me to have a leg to stand on to teach people about farming, I needed to get my hands dirty and actually work on a production farm. And so I started at Hawthorne Valley as an apprentice, and that was back in 2010. So worked here for 2 years in their apprenticeship program, which is basically a program where in exchange for a stipend and room and board, we have people from kind of all over come and stay at the farm for, you know, 8 to 10 months and work alongside us. And they're involved in all aspects of the farm, from feeding to planting to harvesting to washing, milking the cows, so that they can build those skills to be able to learn how to you know, be a farmer or have their own farm someday.
Uh-huh. And how many apprentices do you have doing this program every year?
Each year we have about 8 to 10 apprentices, and some focus just on vegetables, some focus just on livestock, and then some kind of rotate between it all, so work with both.
Mm-hmm. And how long have you been doing it?
This is my 5th season. So I was an apprentice for 2 years, and then I've been managing the field vegetables and CSA for 3 seasons now.
And that is just sounds like the most mind-boggling job to me. Like, how do you figure out how much you need to plant for 300 CSA shares and the farm store, which is an amazing store. For those of you that have not been up there, definitely worth a visit. And then five farmers markets in the city. How do you grow all that?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a big puzzle. You know, we grow 50 to 60 different types of vegetables, 150 different varieties, and all of those crops have different needs. You know, your lettuce needs different stuff than your tomatoes and your potatoes and your winter squash. But, you know, that's really what I spend most of my winter doing, is sitting down with seed catalogs and Excel spreadsheets and crop maps and, you know, really reflecting on past seasons and kind of tailoring how much we plant. Like, oh, gosh, we really could have used, you know, more kale this season, so I need to plant this many more bed feet to do our best to supply to, you know, our first priority is our CSA members, because they've, you know, paid at the beginning of the season. They made a commitment to our farm, so we want to honor that commitment by, you know, giving them lots of really beautiful, bountiful vegetables. Mm-hmm. You know, but over time you kind of gain a sense of like what are your yields going to be. And we really try and focus on soil health and, you know, doing crop rotation and cover cropping to make sure that our soil is as healthy as possible so that it will have the best crop yields as possible. Mm-hmm. and you know, get the most out of our land.
Uh-huh. With a vegetable like kale, where I know you can keep picking the leaves and it keeps growing more, same with Swiss chard. Do you find it's better to do a lot of succession plantings, that you have new plants coming up behind the old plants, or do you harvest some leaves at a time and keep having the same plants replenishing? And if you do that, how do you manage the harvesting days for the leaves, you know,
yeah,
if you need it every week?
So it's a mix of both. So we do succession planting, definitely. You know, kale, we do four successions over the course of the season. So we'll do our first planting, you know, early in April, as soon as we can get into the ground, another planting, you know, late May, and then again in July, and another one in August, so that we'll have kale throughout the whole season.
Right.
But then again, we can harvest off of each succession multiple times, you know, so we, so it's a matter of planting enough so that, you know, maybe on Monday when we're harvesting for CSA, we'll take all of the kale from one bed of kale and then let that rest for a week or so, and then have a second bed of kale that we'll harvest from for the markets and for the next week's CSA. So it's kind of trying to have enough planted so that you can give your plants enough recovery time to put on that new growth. But yeah, we definitely employ succession planting to really increase our harvest windows. And ensure that we have like a nice variety of vegetables all throughout the whole season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's one of the hardest things. And then also to try to harvest and, you know, and pay attention to the calendar, because you're harvesting every week, and every week is not a harvesting week, right?
Right. Right. So. Well, every, you know, there are certain days within the week that are for particular crops, you know, and so we mostly pay attention to the planting calendar, or the planting calendar in the planting and the greenhouse and the starting the plants. Doing the harvesting on root days or leaf days or, you know, that kind of thing is a little trickier. So we kind of do the best we can with that.
Right, right. Yeah, I would think you have to, there has to be some give, you know?
Right, because for instance, today, you know, we're harvesting for the weekend market today. So my crew's out there in the field, you know, getting lettuce and arugula and spinach and kale, but then we also are going to be getting carrots and turnips and leeks and onions. And so kind of throughout a whole day, we harvest, you know, up to, you know, 10 to 15 different crops, depending what's on our pick sheet for that day.
Uh-huh. Now, things like lettuce and arugula, you've already had a frost. Are those in the greenhouse, or are they still out in the field?
Those are still out in the field, and so we did spent a lot of time covering our tender greens last week. You know, I check the weather pretty obsessively, trying to stay on top of what the temperatures are going to be, especially at this time of year. And so we had a double cover of a row cover. It's like a spun plastic cloth that you can put over your crop for frost protection. And so we fared pretty well. It got down to about 17 degrees here on Sunday night, so pretty cold. But mostly everything came out unscathed. So there's a little bit of frost burn on some of the lettuce, but we actually ended up being okay.
Because I came home Saturday night, and I was like, I had to put my headlight on, my lamp on my head, and go out, and I, like, harvested all of my arugula, like, in the one night, because I was just like, I'm not losing this arugula. And it was like, you know, 10 o'clock at night or 11 o'clock at night, I'm there with my scissors and my headlight harvesting the end of my arugula just not to lose it.
You got to get it in.
right. Wow. That, I just can't imagine keeping all that together. It's quite impressive, Lucy. Quite impressive.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a big job, you know, but it really, it's just so rewarding, you know. I can't really think of anything else I'd want to be doing.
Well, that's great, and it's such important work, and especially the teaching. You know, I mean, of course, giving everyone vegetables is important work, but passing it on and helping others learn, it's the best way, because there are so, especially with biodynamics, because there's so many small aspects to it that make such a big difference. And you can't just, you know I've tried learning on my own. I mean, I wish I had the time to come and do a program like yours, you know, like to live there.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I have a lot of the remedies that I've sent away for, you know, and trying to get that hour to you know, to spin it and get the vortex going. And
you
know, I've gone up to the Pfeiffer Center and done a day workshop, but there's just so much. It's so hard. And I think the best way of learning is hands-on, doing it over a season so that you really
Absolutely. And, you know, it's especially when you look at there are all these statistics out there about, you know, the majority of farmers in our country now are approaching the retirement age. So it's a question of, you know, who's going to grow our food? You know, who's going to feed us? So it's really exciting and inspiring to be a part of this movement of, you know, young people who are looking around and saying, oh, gosh, this is an issue. And so there are a lot of young people getting into farming.
It's really encouraging. Really encouraging.
And
so
I
listen,
think
before
it
we
feels
run out
really
of time,
good to be able to help shape the next generation of people that are going to kind of carry us forward.
Absolutely. And before we run out of time, I'd like you to share with everyone how they can get in touch with you and the Hawthorne Valley Farm. So if they want to participate, they can reach out.
Yeah, absolutely. You can visit our website at hawthornvalleyfarm.org, and it'll kind of tell you all about the different things that we do. If you're interested in our CSA program, there's a link for that. And then you can always email me, lucy@hawthornvalleyfarm.org, if you have any questions about anything we've talked about today or just in general.
Thank you. Thanks, Lucy, for taking time in your busy day to join us. And everybody out there, thank you so much for listening in. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Bye for now, and I'll see you all again next week.